Right. So, you know, last week we spent a lot of time discussing DFT, specifically this like quasi-exact Hohenberg cone Cham DFT. Right. So I wanted to bridge that over into what we're going to talk about this week. So, you know, we did all this hard work constructing DFT, and where did that get us? Just want to emphasize, one of the main takeaways I hope you guys got from last week was that it's not mean field theory, right? So sometimes people, it has that reputation, but I mean, not to bash mean field theory, right? You can learn a lot from mean field theory, but DFT is this systematic approach where you can you know, make things closer and closer to the real system. You know, you can really get the real interacting density and energy, and this is really valuable. But you know, it's not sort of, you know, we're never expecting it to take us all the way to strongly correlated systems for sort of deep reasons having to do with why, you know, the kind of approximations that we can make. I mean, there are some interesting. There is some interesting work to that end, I should mention. So there are people working very hard. In the Netherlands, actually, there's one group that is actually saying, let's get rid of the cone-cham system. So let's not map to a non-interacting system to try to get the density. This is why it's important to realize it's not a mean field theory, right? That you could use any substitute system. So that what they're doing is they're mapping to a system that only has interactions and has no kinetic energy at all. And then they're trying to start from there. So that's some interesting stuff. But so, in the meantime, what do we have to deal with strong correlation? We have lattice models. Okay. So this is just sort of an approach that we have at the moment. So just if I can say a little bit more about, just a guess about where the field may go in the future, is that we may be kind of in the days of lattice models at the moment, but it could be that in the not so distant future that this is, we'll look back on this as something of a crutch. I mean, obviously, we'll still be using lattice models probably forever, but we may look back on this as something more of like a way to understand qualitatively things, but more and more people are doing calculations where they can actually keep larger and larger amounts of the microscopics. So there's sort of different philosophies, like we can construct these to try to get, you know, quantitative results, but we could also just think about these as sort of cartoons, okay, on some level. So when do we need them, right? So what are correlation effects, right? So correlation effects, okay, when we say like strongly correlated, people mean that interactions dominate kinetic plus potential. Okay, I say kinetic plus potential because what we're gonna get to today is something where we basically combine the like one body potential and kinetic part of the Hamiltonian together into these thing called like a hopping model, which you've seen probably from Marcel, this kind of tight binding. But we'll do it a little more systematically and try to convince you that it's like an exact rewriting of the original microscopic Hamiltonian in principle. You know, it's hard to actually carry that out. And so this is what people mean, right? So sometimes I kind of bristle a little bit when I read in books and people say weakly interacting or strongly interacting, just because conceptually the interactions never get turned off, right? They're always there. So it's not really that what people call weakly correlated systems are weakly interacting. I mean, you know, in a certain sense you could say that. It just depends on what you mean precisely by it. But I'd rather say that they're, you know, always strongly interacting, but it's just a question of like what dominates, right? What really drives the behavior? That's kind of the question, right? So as we saw, right, so interactions dominate kinetic and potential. As we saw, kinetic and potential is what gives a band structure picture. So if you only focus on those, you get this picture of band structure, and band theory, you know, is very successful for a large class of materials. And we saw that, that there's a way to sort of push band structure very far. And so basically there's this cone-sham DFT picture that basically, you know, you can sort of build interactions into the band structure, right? But it's subtle because a lot of times people think that you're supposed to take that band structure and treat it as the answer, but it's really some kind of intermediate thing, right? It's just some step along the road. And what you do is you really just borrow its density, and then you're supposed to just throw it away and get the energy from that. But you know, you can do other things with this band structure. So we'll talk about that a little bit. That maybe, you know, taking these states from this band structure a little more seriously is one approach. So But just to kind of step back, so what, you know, what we're leading to is we want to construct lattice models. That's something that people do, and it's important to understand where kinetics matter is at and what people have been learning. And so what do we mean? How do we know, or like when do interactions dominate kinetic plus potential picture of things, right? And basically, there's this tight binding picture. Where we just have a picture of atomic orbitals, so we have some atoms, right? And in 3D, they kind of look like this. Just go down to infinity. And we have some orbitals on each atom. But let's just think of maybe like hydrogen atoms, something really simple. So we're just focusing on sort of one orbital on each atom. This is on a very sketchy level. We'll make this all more precise. And you can summarize the kinetic plus potential effects through this parameter T, which is just, this is very sketchy, so just a cartoon, which is that you just take these orbitals, say the one on atom one, and you integrate it against the kinetic plus potential, okay? And you can also estimate the cost of doubly occupying one of these guys. So you can say U is this thing that's like VEE R minus R prime, and it's like phi 1 of R squared phi 1 of R prime squared. So that's the same orbital on the same atom, right? So you can just say, we'll make this more precise, but these are the two parameters you want to talk about. And if you just focus on this guy first, you get some band picture. And the band has some width that's proportional to T. Okay. So people talk about the bandwidth as just the difference in energies between the uppermost states and the lowermost states. So this is like the biggest, you know, range of energies you can access by filling states in this band. And then you know, moderate to strong correlations is when U is comparable to T or even much bigger than T. Okay, that's what people mean by strongly correlated, right? So just the reason this is important just to say that there is like a scale, there's like an emergent scale, right? And it's not, so we're not comparing exactly some bare scales here. We're not just saying, what's the number in front of VEE, you know, something like this, and comparing it to something bare here. It comes through these orbitals, right? So first we satisfy the kinetic energy and the potential. So there's some kind of first pass of the system, which you say everything wants to be in some orbitals that are like close to atomic orbitals. And here we're thinking about certain classes of systems where the orbitals are rather tightly bound. I'll tell you more about what those are. And then, you know, there's some overlaps of these orbitals that leads to some emergent scale T. And then we also project interactions into these same orbitals and we get U. And so this would be moderate, strong, just loosely here, but this is just to give you a feeling of what do people mean and what are we really comparing when we say something is correlated. So, did I hide the board? Yeah, I didn't mean to do that. Oops. Things are too fancy. Hold on, that's the middle board. Right, this is the front board. Okay, good deal. What am I doing wrong? Oh, it's too low. Okay, good deal. Sorry, Monday. Hope this is entertaining for you guys. All right. Yeah, rough start to the week. Okay, so when does this story hold, right? So I'm just telling you a story that I think I'm covering up a little bit still. All right. When does this story I just told you hold? So this this strong to moderate correlation picture, okay, In real materials, this often corresponds to D and F bands, okay? So what do I mean by saying bands and then talking about certain orbitals of atoms, right? So if you remember back from this tight binding picture, bands evolve out of atomic orbitals in that picture, right? So that's going all the way to the atomic limit where you just think about assembling a material by bringing, you know, atoms from infinity, right? And then you can use this kind of coarse, like, ionic picture of chemistry, and you can think of, say, there's some oxygens that, like, rip, you know, two electrons off of some nearby cations, this kind of thing. And so what people do is they actually do, you know, after they've done one of these DFT calculations, you know, they may find that here's the Fermi energy, and there's some bands crossing this energy, right? And then there's some other kind of broader bands down here, and they can actually go back and take the different block states of these bands, right? And they can actually analyze, you know, where do they have the most weight? So they actually do little integrals and little cells of the real system in 3D, and they actually see, you know, like, with what probability, if you're in this state, with what probability are you actually spending most of your time, say, on an oxygen or like a sulfur atom or something, something that's more structural, or, you know, something that kind of is in between some of these D levels. And they can also analyze these, and they see that these guys correspond, have most of their weight in some particular D orbitals. And so what you'll actually see sometimes are little cartoons of materials where people will, say, draw some kind of D orbitals like this. And then they'll draw, you know, some p orbitals around it. And these really are just cartoons, right? But they're more real than you might think, is all I wanted to say. That if you actually go and look, and I'll post some notes on the wiki of people who are doing some real, like what we'll talk about a little bit today is Vanier orbitals. So people are doing these real Vanier orbital calculations from these bands. So they go all the way into this band picture where you think of electrons as sort of delocalizing. But then you sort of combine back together, and I'll say a bit more in a minute about how you do it. You cobble back together something that's like the leftover bits of what used to be the atomic orbitals, you know, kind of projected into these bands in some sense. And they really do actually look like this. So this isn't just some kind of 100% cartoon. This is almost like what you would see if you go and do these little integrals, or you see where the weight lies of these different bands. And so an important thing to realize is that D and F orbitals are they really are tightly bound. Okay, let's think about why. So if you think about the 3D orbitals, then just heuristically, you know, so these things are defined on the atomic level. Well, part of what they have to do is be orthogonal to all the previous orbitals that have been filled, right? But these have a different angular momentum character. So they can basically be orthogonal just due to their different character, and they don't have to necessarily push outward radially as much to achieve being orthogonal, right? So just because of this angular structure. So these tend to be, so basically angular structure means that their average radius is smaller than you might otherwise think. Maybe then say the comparable, you know, s orbitals in the same shell, right? Okay, and so then because of this, this tends to mean relatively smaller t, and also relatively larger u at the same time, right? So both when electrons doubly occupy these things, they're forced closer together, right? Larger u, and they just don't overlap as much because their average, you know, radial distance is smaller, so smaller t. So that's exactly falling into this setup that I mentioned that we were calling correlated, right? So when u starts to become comparable to t or even to dominate t. Okay, so then, you know, there's different ways of attacking this, but one that people do is they basically say, let's try to construct lattice models. Okay, so you can kind of think of these in two ways, right? So we can think of these as, you know, basically there could be simple for people, right? or they could be simple for computers. Both are important, right? People use computers. So we're going to see that, you know, again, this is just one attack. I want to emphasize that there are approaches where people are trying to keep more and more and more of sort of everything, all the details that are contained in one of these DFT calculations, and then just add interactions in some quasi-exact controlled way. I mean, the problem with these schemes right now is that they have to resort to some uncontrolled part, so they have to, there's an issue I'm not gonna go into at all, but there's this problem called, say, double counting, where if you started out with some DFT band structure, already has built in some interaction effects in some sense, right? And so then if you just try to like throw in the interactions, treat these orbitals, you know, like that's it, and then throw in the interactions, then you might find that you're kind of including them both in the Cohen-Chan potential and directly, and this is too much. But there's progress being made. So, but in the meantime, what we have to do is we have to construct some lattice model and maybe treat the parameters as empirical, and then maybe we can actually still get quantitative agreement. Or we can just explore the full range of parameters of these lattice models and then try to understand different phases of matter that can occur. But let's talk about a little bit more about how we can do this sort of semi-empirically. So, so from bands, we get block states. Right, so these guys, what do they look like? So there's this band index alpha, and that one way of thinking about that is it tells you that as this thing moves back and forth through the system, as it goes through each unit cell, it has some particular shape that roughly, you know, in a system like in a D band, these shapes actually look like the atomic orbitals that they derive from, right? So, but let's think maybe in some kind of cartoon picture about these. So here's say a bunch of 1D atomic sites. And as this block state visits each site, it has some character that might look like this, right? So this is just a cartoon. Okay, so here I'm kind of thinking of like little boxes, and this might be like the first excited state of particle in a box or something like this. Okay. Sure. Yeah, okay, I thought of this. I like this question because I was pondering this the other week too. So when I was writing up these notes. So the question is, you know, sure, the 3D orbitals may be more tightly bound radially than say the 3S or something, maybe even the 4S, it can just depend. Don't quote me on that. But what about, you know, like the 1S orbitals or something, right? So let's see, I had a very simple answer worked out. Let me think for a second. I think it's pretty obvious once you see it. It's just basically that those gain so much energy from being close to the nucleus that there's sort of no reason for them to want to be empty, basically. So they're just like chemically inert. I think that's basically the reason, right? So there's this concept in chemistry when people do quantum chemistry, where they really, one of the kind of goals of quantum chemistry is to really be ab initio, like to a very high level, like even kind of beyond what people in DFT do, meaning that you really start out with all the atomic orbitals and then you try to represent them efficiently on a computer and then really work in that full space, right? But even they will talk about active orbitals and virtual orbitals and sort of inactive orbitals, right? And so the very deep core orbitals, they just take to be 100% filled and just leave it at that. And again, yeah, reasons of chemistry, right? So this binding of the nucleus is just very strong. And so that there's no reason to empty those states out. So those are always filled in. They can get excited in certain experiments where people, like say, send in very high energy X-rays. And then you can actually eject. Sorry? Yeah. Right, we are considering.
This is then implying that carbon, you get something small, which doesn't have that effect, would experience strong correlations more than a heavy metal. Because they wouldn't have that problem with the lower orbitals so sucked in as much.
You're saying that carbon would have strong correlations?
Well, I mean,
or?
That's, you know, if you're saying, you're saying like in a single atom, that the, you know, the inner orbitals are inert. That's
yeah.
If I was to take two different atoms of different shape, sorry, different atoms of different number of protons, then you know, the one with less protons is going to have lower orbitals that are active. So you know, it might have, say, the two p orbitals being or the two s orbitals being you know, able to bond with, but the other. I know that I thought strong correlation.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And my understanding of why they're seen more in like the transition, you know, transition metal compounds is again, yeah, the same thing I was saying about that, that the sort of the active states correspond to these more tightly bound D and F bands and things, right? So that's consistent, right? Okay, thanks for the question. Yeah, because it's, you know, what I'm saying on a very naive level sounds like it could apply to those, but there's just other things you have to consider, right? So there's no reason to empty those states out. So they just aren't chemically active. Right, so okay, so we have these this picture of bands, which you can either think of these as sort of solving the sort of bare band structure of the system or solving the Cohen-Sham system. And there's schemes where people try to obtain orbitals from both and maybe even some third way I don't know about. And so you get these block states. And you know, they have some local character, but of course they also have some overall envelope, right? So here I'm showing, say, just the real part of this thing, because really there's some complex phase factor. So this would be, say, what one would look like if K was close to zero, right? Where basically this envelope is almost not changing at all. But then what we can do is we can take other states from the same band, right? So we can think of keeping this alpha fixed, and then taking different k's. And so what we could get would be, say, a guy with like an envelope like the following. Okay, so maybe it has the same phase here, but then the phase could be flipped here, okay? And then maybe again the same phase here, or the same sign, I mean. I'm just thinking of a little 1D system with like a little simple little boxes or something like this, okay? Yeah, so the shapes here, I just am trying to give a cartoon of the idea that like what a block state looks like, right? Is it looks like a some big plane wave. But then if you like zoom in on it locally, it has some extra wiggles. And those wiggles are to satisfy some additional like local physics, like involving something roughly like particle in a box or sort of solving the hydrogen atom and putting all these shells, right? So here, just so I can draw it on the board, I'm thinking more like, what if this is like one of these particle, you know, repeated particle in a box problems, some little tunneling between each box, right? So then this would be something like the first excited state, you know, of the box, just repeated, but then with some overall phase, right? And that's what these bands mean, right? So the bands descend from sort of the levels of just this box alone. So if you just take this thing and solve it, right, it has all these spaced out states, then they start to mix together as you bring them together, right? That's the picture. So, you know, this would be one where sort of K is close to pi. And then, you know, there's other ones, say, with different shapes. So there's another one that maybe looks like this or something. But again, it's going to have the same, you know, I'm picking ones that always have a plus one sign in the middle here, right? Okay, so we see that if we, this is just heuristic, we see that if we add these all up, that we can get cancellations, right? So like, this might cancel with that, okay? But these would add constructively, all right? So I'm just trying to motivate that, if you take these particular combinations, they're called Vanier orbitals. So in here is like the number of sites of our system. Okay, a site is like one of these wells. And then we sum over all the momentum in the first Brillouin zone. Okay, so we find that these guys are now localized around some atom at position Rj, right? So now if you think about, you know, one of these realistic materials, really J would be labeling a unit cell, right? And then alpha is going to be labeling different bands, so that corresponds to different orbitals that fit inside this unit cell, right? So like in this picture I drew where I drew some d orbitals and some oxygen p orbitals around it, say, then a unit cell would have maybe both of those oxygens and one of those d's, right? And so then this alpha would sort of index over whether you're on the oxygen or on the d, one of the d orbitals in there. And the j would just tell you which box you're in, right? So it'd be kind of like, this is, you know, j, some j, and then here's, can't draw it. So, right? So this might be like alpha equals 1, alpha equals 2. Well, I guess it'd be like alpha equals 1, alpha equals 2, alpha equals 3, roughly. Okay, this one would be sort of a higher band. And then this would just be some j, and there'd be another box somewhere else, j prime, right? Just to give you a rough sense of what you should think about each of these things meaning, right? So kind of band index would move you around in here, and then the j's would move you to different regions, right? So if we set alpha to be like a p band, and then j to be here, then we'll find a Vanier orbital will be sort of peaked on one of these oxygens, okay? But it'll have a shape similar to that oxygen. So it actually would be like this guy or something, all right? So basically, from the bands, we can kind of resolve back things that look like the descendants of the original atomic orbitals of the system. But they'll somehow be mixed together in a way that satisfies the kinetic and potential energy, okay? So somehow we're going to build in, you know, orbitals that somehow already keep a very low kinetic and potential energy, so we don't pay a big cost there. And then we can just project the interactions into these. Okay, so now being a little bit more formal about it, so I just wanted to argue to you that, you know, you can get these Vanier orbitals and they can provide a good basis for, you know, keeping the kinetic and potential energy low. So now let's just assume we have them. So we can create these operators that create and annihilate states into these Vanier orbitals. You can always do this, you know, with any set of orthogonal functions, starting from the psi daggers, which are the continuum electron creation operators, right? So I could put any function here, but let's think of these Vanier orbitals. And so here I'm going to combine, as it suits me, I'm going to combine what I called the band and the unit cell index. I'm going to combine that just into a collective index most of the time, right? So if I just write J without any alpha or something, so if I just write a Roman letter, then now this goes over orbitals, right? So if we think of taking all different choices of alpha and I, then, you know, again, choosing alpha puts me maybe on one of these different atoms in here, and choosing I puts me in different boxes of the system, different big chunks of the system. So if I pick a pair, that's just putting me on a particular atom somewhere, in a particular orbital of a particular atom, right? So that's what this I corresponds to, is like go to some atom in some location and then pick one of a specific orbital. Right, so these are orbitals. And then corresponding to this, I can also unwrap this definition just by orthogonality and completeness of these guys, of these Vanier orbitals. Okay, so I wanted to write it in that form too, because that shows us how we can now take our continuum Hamiltonian, right? So this is what we wanted to study, was something now we've written many times last week, but once more won't hurt us, right? Let's write in a slightly more suggestive form. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I checked these pretty carefully, so I believe that's the correct definition. Right. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I chose, this is sort of a choice to not put the star when you define it this way. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of the most natural way to do it. And then I wrote it in sort of a doubly flipped order, right? So it's doubly flipped in the sense of I removed the dagger and I wrote, you know, the inverse relationship, and so that kind of undoes the star, you know. So you can think of it as sort of like you'd get one star from the fact that you're projecting back into real space, and then another star from the fact that I didn't write the formula for psi dagger, I wrote the formula for psi. Yeah, we can, maybe it'll be useful, actually, that might be a good exercise for me just to check that for you guys right now, just to show you, convince you that this is the right definition. So we just, all we have to do is plug things back in. So we keep what we wrote, and then from this definition, right, we just remove, we just go through with a Hermitian conjugate of things, right? So we should get a phi star j. Okay. And yeah, right. And then what we do is we let's see.
You've got orthogonality on the sum of row.
Yeah, that's right. But am I missing something here? I think there's no sum over j. I think that's just still I. Yeah, exactly. So you do the sum over I, and that gives you a that gives you a delta function of r and r prime. And then you get back. Yeah. Yeah, sure. I think that's a worthwhile thing to do, actually. OK, so you guys are convinced that this is like the OK formula. So again, it's a little confusing because I sort of did a double transformation there. Right. But you know, this one is sort of easier to see why it's defined this way, because you can think of it as going to each point and putting down a delta function and just weighting the height of that delta function by our target orbital, right? So instead of thinking of it as creating some orbital, you can think of it as creating a bunch of little lines that fill out that orbital, right? It's the same thing. That's what you can think of this integral as doing. So it's going, putting them down like that, right? Okay, and recall, these are operators, right? So n hat of r is psi dagger r sigma psi r sigma, summed over sigma. So sometimes you see this written out in this very messier form with four psi operators, and we'll write it sort of like that in a second, but right now, actually. So, okay, a key point is that this same Hamiltonian can be written as follows, using our new basis. So this is the point is this is an exact rewriting of the Hamiltonian if we make the following definitions of T and B. And this is something you can check. Okay. So we have these things T's, which usually they're called hopping, but I think the name T, I'm guessing, probably comes from tunneling. Okay. And these are just defined like follows. So there's a conventional minus sign that's put in there and here, so it's just a convention. Okay, so H0 is the non-interacting stuff, and our Hamiltonian is all the quadratic stuff, right? So this is like the thing that gives you the band structure. And so you just take that and you just project it into this set of localized and orthogonal orbitals. And then you just call these the T's, all right? So the idea is that if you just take the part of this lattice Hamiltonian, right? It's called a lattice now, right? Because we have these discrete labels, right? So that's what we mean by lattice. You just take it and just forget about the V part and just solve this back. You can do it on that lattice, and you should get the same energies and band structure as if you just solve this thing, right? So it's just some transformation, like a unitary transformation. And then the Vs are defined pretty similarly. So you know, it's funny. We'll do all this work right now to be really careful and, you know, write the sum correctly. And then what we're going to do is just throw away most of these, right? But I think it's important to keep in mind that there is some exact road there if anyone could walk it, right? And again, I think it's important to realize too that quantum chemists do walk this road. And so this is something that I'm hoping may get imported more and more into Kennett's matter. I think it used to be a crazy proposition to say, let's study this thing, keeping as many of the T's and the V's that we can. But that was, you know, an attitude that originates kind of from before the time of computers a bit. And now, you know, people in chemistry are doing problems like this all the time with huge numbers of these Vs kept and Ts. And that now I think there's a bit of an attitude of people saying, why not also do this in condensed matter? Like, why are we only doing this full set of things? And I say full, of course, there's some things they don't include that are sort of obviously totally unimportant, but a very large set of these. You know, why couldn't we do this in condensed matter too? So I think this is going to be an interesting trend to see people. One line of research might be to see, can we keep more and more and more of these things, basically exactly, and then try to solve the resulting complicated model. And so it's interesting, there's actually a lot of research that was done in the chemistry world in terms of how do we compute, just literally how do we compute these first. So before you solve that thing, you have to have obtained the Vs, and just computing them can be a major part of your calculation. So you're actually running computers for hours and hours and hours just computing Vs, before you then go and try to solve this extremely non-trivial interacting problem as a second step. So it's kind of interesting problem to have that we don't think about writing down the Hamiltonian as like a hard part of a calculation, but in a certain sense that can be a very deep problem, or not deep, but sort of hard problem. It's like, how do you even obtain a good Hamiltonian, right? So that's important to think about. There's a lot, and maybe just a few more words, there's a lot of other stuff they do, like they try to, since you don't want to really work with the full set of all these T's and V's, you might try to sort of do perturbation theory on some of the very high-lying states, for instance, and kind of try to build those in into your orbitals and somehow include them in some like virtual level. All right, so again, this is just a transformation. And what are we hoping for, right? So, but kind of going back, that was me telling you a little bit of advertisement of some things people do in chemistry, but kind of the old school view of the lattice models though, right, is that we hope, it's just a hope maybe, that that we can treat Tij and Vijkl as short-ranged. So maybe it's enough to just keep a few of these guys. And that's what we're going to do probably for the rest of the time today is classify these things, meaning just let's see what have we wrought, right? What's inside of the T's and the V's? So if we kind of pick special ones, what physics do they contain? And what we're going to do the rest of today and then like maybe the first half of tomorrow, maybe a lot of tomorrow, is see that there's like emergent interactions, right? So if you think of the Baer-Coulomb interaction, I tend to think of it, I mean, it's probably correct, right, that it's just sort of charges moving around in space interacting, right? And the spins are just going along for the ride. But as we'll see, the spins get interactions of their own due to kind of emergent effects. The fact that we have already satisfied a lot of the kinetic energy by packing everything into orbitals, then spin interactions are going to kind of start popping out of that, sort of at some emergent level, right? So that's interesting. But so, okay, the hope is that this is short-ranged. One more bit of words about some other strategies people are trying to do to deal with this mess, right? Which is that there's too many of these, and that maybe we can't even reliably calculate them all. And some DFT codes, you don't even really have all the core and excited orbitals. You've kind of erased them and replaced them with like these things called pseudo-potentials, say for some of the core orbitals. So you may not even literally have these, be able to obtain these for all possible I, J, K, and L. And also, you don't want to keep them all around. So another thing, say, that people do is they actually will do screening calculations. So what they may do is they may say, let's only look at some of the lower lying bands, like some of these S and P orbitals that are sort of close by, and they'll do mean field sort of RPA calculations. So they'll do some diagrammatics, you know, some Feynman diagrams, and they'll work out a replacement for VEE that includes the physics of screening. So the idea here is that you put a test charge in the system, and all of these lower lying orbitals run around, like those electrons run around, and they block this test charge, right? And they cut off the effect of its interactions on other, you know, these other bands. So really, you know, we should think of this on some level maybe as some kind of effective VEE where we've already thought about the effects of these less strongly correlated electrons that are just sort of running around very quickly in the system. Okay, so that's just some other words about stuff people are doing. But, you know, looking through a lot of the literature on this, there's still a lot of, you know, heuristics kind of dogging that program, right? So this program of trying to deal with the screening in some kind of controlled way and kind of trying to deal with some of the double counting effects where people try to use, instead of V, they want to use the Cohn-Sham potential and use these orbitals from the Cohn-Sham system, but that already includes the interactions on some levels. So then are you including them twice by putting in the Vs? You know, there's all these kind of questions sort of dogging this kind of work. So I'm going to leave those for your own reading. Okay, so now let's classify these guys, right? So starting closest to that kind of in the shortest range stuff, there's this interesting set of the T's, which you could call the crystal field matrix. There may be different definitions of crystal field running around, but this is one I saw from a band structure expert's notes. I'll post some of these notes to the wiki. They're very interesting. And we could call this epsilon alpha beta. And this is taking, I'm going to put in the band indices back for just a moment, and then we're mostly going to get rid of them after this, and just use these collective indices that label orbitals. So here, exposing again the band indices and the unit cell indices. So here, these are unit cells now. So these are like these whole boxes containing a set of different atomic orbitals. What we could do is we can just zoom in on just that problem of just one of those little unit cell boxes, and then we can ask, what are the projections of just the non-interacting part of the Hamiltonian into these different atomic orbitals that are living inside this little cell, right? And that's just a finite problem on some finite size system that we could diagonalize, right? And we'll find generically that these are spaced out, right? These should be non-degenerate in general and kind of spaced out. So this is called crystal field effects. So the idea is that there are nearby orbitals that will split what were previously degenerate atomic levels, right? So we may have had some d orbitals of just a bare transition metal atom or something, right? But then these d orbitals will be split by the presence of other orbitals around and sort of tunneling in and out of those other orbitals, right? And so in general, this is dealt with in some level of symmetries and group theory, right? So when people are taking the perspective of that lattice models are just for people, right? For people to just understand what the physics is of a certain transition metal compound or something, you know, like say one of the materials that exhibits like high TC superconductivity, they just want to understand, you know, like, okay, the parent compound seems to be a spin half antiferromagnet. Why is that, you know? And so what's going on? Like, how did this thing that had, say, like, you know, 10 electrons in its d level turn into a spin a half. And so some of that comes from this crystal field. So the idea that most of these levels are split off, and you may only have sort of one electron at the top of this tower of levels after you've diagonalized this thing that's really playing the active role in all the chemistry and everything. Yeah, exactly. So one, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. So one story that often comes out of this is that if you have 3D electrons, and if they're in, say, an octahedral environment, then you can make a phenomenological, that's a lot of letters, potential okay, you can make this kind of phenomenological crystal field potential, and that generally leads you to a picture where you have a splitting of out of the five orbitals, out of the five angular momentum levels, you have three lower ones that are called the T2G, and two higher ones which are called EG. And I used to have the worst time remembering these, and then I just realized that the number of letters is the number of these levels. So if you ever find yourself getting them mixed up, just count the number of letters, right? So there's three here and two there, right? So whoever designed that was helpful. And so these will split, and then there'll be other splittings that can happen. So I'm not gonna go way into all these, because I wanted to sort of get on later in this week. So just to give you guys a bit more about what we're gonna do this week, we're gonna descend pretty fast after tomorrow from this kind of chemical level of talking about things, or this kind of quasi, ab initio type of thing, to just really some cartoon lattice models that people study. And then these already are sort of too rich even for us to handle, things like the Hubbard model and the Heisenberg model, which you've already seen a little bit of. And then we're going to, hopefully on Wednesday and Thursday, go through some very interesting behaviors of some extended Heisenberg models and some generalizations thereof, and see what kind of phases can come out. But there can be other effects, like Jahn-Teller distortions. Okay, and so in these, the octahedral cage of, say, other atoms around, like, say, here again, we have a picture of, like, some kind of d orbitals surrounded by, say, oxygen p orbitals. This cage of oxygen p orbitals can just shift due to instabilities of the system, just electronic instabilities. And then this can split things even more. So you end up with, like, a tower in the end of these orbitals. And so... okay, maybe so. So I will, sort of, I'm not remembering all the details. But basically, they can split even more. Okay, this is a very schematic drawing. I don't remember how it looks afterwards. So, this can resolve finally kind of how many active electrons you have when you really are thinking about now processes involving neighboring unit cells. Okay, so that's just a quick word or two about this crystal field matrix, right? So then in the end, we may only be interested in focusing on some one band that's coming from the highest of these. So the rest can be filled. It depends on the situation. So now, the most important, that's sort of the most local, right? So then we have other important interactions in this out of these T's and V's. So the next neighbor hopping is very important. Okay, so this is just T. It's often just called T without any subscripts. Right, so it could be where it's now you're within the same band, but on different unit cells. Right, so again, you may have these unit cells, and then each one may contain a particular, say, d orbital. And we're focusing on those because those are the ones where lattice models are especially needed and relevant. Right, and so then a T can, if you look back at the form of this lattice model, right, you see that the T is always proportional to a C dagger C, right? So it annihilates an electron somewhere and then puts it somewhere else, right? So that's why it's called a hopping. But really underneath, it's a tunneling process, right? So it's some interplay between kinetic energy and the electrons want to spread out, but then there's these little potential barriers that block them, but they still gain some energy by occasionally crossing these barriers, right? That's the underneath physics that's going on. So it's important to remember, sometimes people call this the kinetic energy of the lattice model, or they refer to it as a kinetic effect, which it is. But it's important to remember that it really contains both kinetic and potential effects there's some interplay of those, right? Okay, that's important to remember. I say that because, you know, people tend to think of all these as somehow independent of each other. Again, if you go to the extreme of just thinking that lattice models are sort of toys for people to play around with, which is a fine view, but it's important to remember that in a more realistic kind of ab initio setup, these things are not sort of all independent. I mean, if you actually take a real system and put pressure on it, the T's and the V's are all going to change, and you may not be able to control only changing the T's without changing the V's, something like that. Okay. And so now, of course, I'd say, you know, maybe most important interaction that we're going to talk about is this thing called the Hubbard U. So let's define it as, with a factor of two, maybe just as a convention. And it's just VIII. So we're just, now what we're going to do is pick out certain ones of these Vs, right? So there's a huge number of them. We're just going to focus on, like, maybe two different kinds, essentially. So this one is very important. This is just the kind of classical level Coulomb interaction, but localized to one orbital. I say classical because it has the form of a, kind of looks like a Hartree interaction, sort of a density-density kind of thing. There's actually a variant of DFT. I kind of hesitate to call it DFT. It's sort of outside of DFT, but there's this thing you'll hear about called LDA plus U. And what people do is they actually take an LDA band structure and then they try to calculate this U from the orbitals of this LDA band structure and then somehow, you know, put them into the actual Cohen-Sham system and sort of treat that as a real system. So this is something you'll hear about. Just so you know, that's the same U, but it's sort of notoriously hard to get the right U. And again, if you think about where does this come from and, you know, what operators does this correspond to, this is like taking these C guys and contracting them, or sort of grouping them this way. Right, so if we only include, if we just fix this term, the operator that it weights is like this operator, where we sum over the spins this way, okay? Yeah, that's the main point of what I'm writing here. Yeah, exactly. That the spins are sort of, the spin physics gets summed out, and we only get sort of charge physics, okay, by just focusing on just this one term. So we do the spin sums, and they pair up like that, right? To contrast that, there's other Vs that are going to give us spin interactions, okay? This one does not. Not so directly. We'll see that it actually does lead to a type of spin interaction, but when you combine it with kinetic energy effects. So at this level, it doesn't. Okay, and of course, you can also think about further neighbor. Right, so you could have some something sometimes people call the second neighbor one just V without any subscripts, but I'm not going to write that. I'll just write VIIJJ. And that would be very similar, but where now you do this integral over two different orbitals, right? So you just want to know what's the repulsion that if you occupy an orbital here and an orbital there, like what kind of charge repulsion do they feel, right? So these are actually very important. I should mention that along with these hoppings, there's also further neighbor T's, right, of course. Sometimes people call the second neighbor one T prime or something. But basically, again, this just involves hops to further orbitals somewhere else. So all these are generically present unless there's some symmetry or something that exactly sets them to be zero. Okay, so I'll just set up, we'll finish talking about this tomorrow, but I'll just set up a little bit of this idea of exchange mechanisms. Okay, I put exchange in quotes because that word is used maybe in some slightly inequivalent ways, but in general it refers to the fact that you can't have totally uncorrelated electrons, right? They always obey Pauli exclusion. And so this leads to some interesting outcomes, all right? So basically, there's two main varieties, right? There's Coulomb exchange, which we'll briefly talk about right now and discuss a little further tomorrow. And this is an on-site primarily effect. On-site, site again means orbital, right? So it kind of means happening, site in this case doesn't mean orbital, it sort of means spatially very close together orbitals, right? So maybe two orbitals of the same atom or something. And so site kind of here means atom. And let me just say short range. Short range. And tends to be a ferromagnetic spin interaction. And then there's also kinetic exchange. Okay, and this involves neighboring. So this involves neighboring sites, and it tends to be anti-ferromagnetic, right? And so, you know, kind of who ordered that, right? Because if you look at the sort of bare interactions, they just look like, you know, again, just like charge interacting at different distances. But we're going to see spin interactions pop out. And again, you know, typically this one is anti-ferromagnetic, but we'll discuss a fancier version of kinetic exchange that can lead to also to ferromagnetic spin interactions. So a lot of this depends on all kinds of complicated details, like whether there's a spacer atom in between two orbitals and things like this, okay? So the tutorial for tomorrow is going to be, it's going to involve deriving more precisely a particular version of this kinetic exchange and getting the precise dependence on certain V and T, so this U and T, okay? And so let's just quickly just give an argument about why, how can spin interactions come out of these Vs when it may not look like it, right? So so basically, let's just focus on a particular type of V. So we saw that we talked about V with all I's, right? And there's also this one where it's II followed by JJ. What about, though, this guy, right? So what if we have VIJ? J-I. Hold on. So there was a few things mixed together. So it's definitely a fact that they can't really land on the same point, right? Unless they have the same spin, they can, opposite spin, they can sort of overlap in space, but same spin, they can't, right? This is not obvious, right? So this kinetic exchange neighboring sites that you get an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, it's not an obvious thing. So we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about that kind of right now and then and finish it tomorrow. But Coulomb exchange, essentially, it's very simple. I'll say this again tomorrow. It's just this idea that they can avoid each other better if their spins are aligned. That's it. So if their spins are aligned, then when you see what kind of wave functions are consistent with that just by statistics, they tend not to have as much spatial overlap. So then if you integrate this against the Coulomb interaction, it's lower between these types of orbitals with those types of spins. That's it. So that's why it primarily happens at short ranges, because that gain that you get by keeping the spins parallel only really buys you a lot when they're very spatially, highly spatially overlapping. Not, you know, 100% overlapping, but I mean when they're sort of, say, two different orbitals from the same atom. So they share a lot of space, right? So, but let's just again motivate sort of more mathematically, how do spin interactions come about, right? This is important too because, you know, maybe very naively you might have thought, I mean, probably you guys don't think this, but some people might think that spin interactions somehow are direct things, right? That somehow it's literally the spin of one electron affecting the other, and those are present, and we haven't included them in our model, but you could, right? So you could actually include dipolar spin interactions, and those are important in certain cases. These spin ices that a lot of people actually at Waterloo study, those can be important, but this is not that kind of spin interaction, right? These are much stronger. So as defined, the V's weight this pattern of operators. And then the sums over J are pairing things like this. So these lines just mean, are just a guide to the eye to say which orbital indices are matching. That's all I mean. I'm not talking about weight contractions or anything fancy. So I'm just saying, you know, see J and J match and I match. So let's bring them closer together to see what kind of operator this is. So we get a minus sign by bringing this C. Yeah, that's right, because, wait, there's two of them. Hold on. Okay, we'll figure this out. Okay, let's bring them close together first, and then we'll think about the sign. Yeah, it should be minus, right? But I'm too close to it up here on the board, so I'm not seeing it. So, okay, I'm just gonna say it's minus. So, but I'm confused because it's passing by two of them, so I'm not. That's what it was. Thank you. Okay, exactly. So you bring it past, and then I also flipped the. Yeah, I had a minus in my notes, but I was looking at it and I didn't see the other pass. Okay, exactly. So this guy goes past these two, no sign penalty, and then you flip these, okay? So then I'm excluding here, there's a term that's just proportional to a density operator that, you know, you can be more careful about these kind of things, but I mean, we're not, you know, I could have just started with these written in a different order and defined it like that or something, so I'm not concerned about those. I'm just focusing on what kind of interaction, you know, 4C kind of terms are there.
So wait, where?
That's right. So here, well, in general, this is an unrestricted sum over sigma and sigma prime. But that's exactly the question I wanted to answer. So why did I write it this way? So in general, you see that that here on the same orbital, right, we can annihilate electron of one spin and then replace it back with a different spin. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. So just as an operator level, you see that this kind of operator has the potential to flip a spin, right, or may not, depending on what values the sigma and sigma prime take, right. So for tomorrow, we're going to need this definition that the familiar spin operators that you're used to, right, often you just think of someone just gives you a spin, right, and it's just a little arrow, you know, tied to some dot or something like this. But really, you know, of course, these come with electrons. So really what we mean is that a spin operator is... defined as follows, okay. Right, so on this one orbital, or this one site, if you will, okay, we can define a spin operator from the C's as follows. So we just weight different combinations of, here it's sigma, sigma prime, here I wrote it as alpha and beta. These just pick off different matrix elements of the poly matrices, and then the mu tells us which poly matrix we get. Okay, so that's the definition we'll use for tomorrow, and so then we'll take that definition, apply that to here, and we'll see what kind of different S interactions we'll get. So we'll get different combinations of these spin operators. Okay, that's it for today. So any questions or comments on this, or any of that? Yeah, good question, right. So yeah, here, that's what's funny about it, right, is we're used to thinking of spin as just this, I mean, if you're used to thinking of kind of this mathematical quantum model world, right, you just think of a spin as like something that's just given to you, like here's a little arrow, and you don't think about maybe more of its microscopic origin. So that's right. So here it's really only a spin in the sense we're thinking about if you project into this, the space where the occupancy is always exactly one. But you can just this is just a perfectly valid operator that you can just define, right? Just to write things in a suggestive way. And then when you do project into this n equals one subspace, or if that projection happens dynamically through the physics of the problem, so you go and you find the ground state and you realize that this orbital is always occupied, say, then this becomes the usual situation of spin that you're thinking about. And we'll see that that's another thing we'll talk about tomorrow, is we'll see precisely that this U that I said is very important. What it's trying to do to the system is form local moments. So it's trying to trap the electrons onto sites. And then when they get trapped singly onto sites, there's an unquenched spin that is described by this operator, right? So that's what it likes to do. Question?
It's kind of interesting writing down that. I haven't thought of it before. If I take this operator, I can use the Hosking-Primakov transformation. Was it Hosking-Primakov that allows you to turn this into another creation operator you do it for electrons as well as for bosons as well. What's the relation? Do you know what the relationship is between these emergent bosons from the spins and the original one?
I don't know. Okay, so the question is, Tom is saying he's seen decompositions like this before, but maybe where you think kind of the other direction. So here we're thinking the Cs are our real guys that go all the way back to our psi daggers, that go all the way back to the continuum electrons that are sort of the fundamental things. And we can see that spins are going to come out of, local spin degrees of freedom will eventually come out, especially if we crank U. I'll kind of give you almost like a proof of this tomorrow in some sense, that if, as U goes to infinities, you really get spins, right? Like in the sense you're thinking, where they really are just spins. Here, it's sort of a definition of an operator where maybe it's not always, you don't always have a local moment, so there could be no particles on that site or something. So it's a definition this way. You're saying that there, you can also kind of go this way, right? So you can say, I want to study a system of spins. I'm not worried about them being there or not. They're just there. And then I can define some effective Cs this way. You can also define bosons that, right? Oh, do you just mean, you just mean the sense that you can, spin a halves, you can, you can always write them as like hardcore bosons where you only, so this is just that point, you kind of have moved into a mathematical realm, like,
right, so, I guess, so yeah. There's absolutely no relationship between the things we see.
Well, there is in a mathematical level. So, I mean, this is a good question. So these bosons that you can treat spin a halves as bosons, and it just is simply a rule where having a boson, say, means the spin is down, and not having it means the spin is up. And these are especially convenient because spins are bosonic in the sense that they're made out of two Cs. So at further neighbor sites, they commute instead of anti-commuting, right? So for all those reasons. But at those bosons are just a mathematical transformation. So it's some kind of mapping. Yeah. And then what's interesting, though, is that to deal with strong correlation physics, there's a whole kind of game that got very popular, especially over like in the 90s, very popular, people are still doing this, where they basically fractionalize things. So they want to study spins, and they'll define partons or something, meaning that they'll come up with mappings like this. And those mappings, this is very important what you asked about, that those mappings are only really valid in a particular subspace of the Hilbert space. So here, we're okay with having our electrons maybe not occupying a certain orbital. Maybe it's a very high energy orbital, like some F orbital, but we only have sort of D electrons or something like that. That's fine for us. But if all you want to study is spins, just spins, and you introduce these fermions to try to do that, you will have situations where now you've gone into a larger Hilbert space, where sometimes you may just not have a spin because there may be no electrons on that site. So people do this whole game where they write this, which is exact as long as you project properly. Then they do mean field theory on it. Then they project at the end, but at that point they've done a very coarse approximation because they've done mean field theory. So, and they've only enforced this constraint in some average level. So there's this whole machinery, that was that's used to study exotic strongly correlated materials, where you precisely introduce fake electrons back from spins. But it's just a kind of a interesting trick or something that people try. But it can give some insight into fractionalization. So next week, that's what I was going to talk about a bit. Not so much that technique, but more microscopically, what is this fractionalization business a bit? So we are going to look at the quantum Hall effect, and this happens very sharply there. Okay. That's it for today. Thanks, guys.